Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberto's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Happy Thanksgiving episode. Joined in the studio today with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez and Piper from Booker and Dax Lab. How you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, we got Joe over in the engineering booth. Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
What are you going to do for the Thanksgiving?
Oh, I'm just going to go back to Baltimore, visit the family. Nice, quiet Thanksgiving.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm excited, though.
You say, that's your excited voice?
I'm excited, though. Yeah, just like that.
Yeah. All right. Nice. And Piper, you're doing what? What are you doing? You're going to go to Vermont?
Vermont.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I've heard that they have no internet and telephone in Vermont. Is that true?
No. No paved roads either.
No? You got to go to New Hampshire for paved roads? Oh. Yeah. Yeah, for those of you that haven't tuned in before and Piper's on, they got a kind of a hate thing going on between Vermont and New Hampshire. What's the only thing that they can agree on there?
Maine?
Yeah, and what about Maine?
It's a dark wilderness.
I actually like Maine quite a lot. I enjoy Maine. But I don't come from up there, so I don't have to worry about it. Stas, what are you going to do?
Parents are here.
Oh, wow. We'll just leave it at that. Parents are here. They rented a house where?
Near New Haven.
And who's going to make the turkey?
Mother.
And how is your mom's turkey?
I'm not going to talk about it every year. I'm not going to talk about it. It's great.
What's the lie? Everyone knows that you're...
It's a little dry.
Yes. A little dry. That's my next band name. A little dry. Calling your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. I'm actually going to a potluck family Thanksgiving thing, so I have no idea what the food will be like at all. But I do know one thing. I am driving there and driving home again from it, which means I will not be having any wine at Thanksgiving.
That sucks.
Yeah, that's the best part.
What are you bringing as part of your potluck?
I have no freaking idea. I have no idea. I've just been, like people, I have, like, Thanksgiving, as it should be for a food person, is one of my all-time favorite holidays. I love myself some Thanksgiving, and this year I have not had any time to devote to it at all. But what I do have is one of Patrick Martin's heritage birds that I'm going to cook as soon as I get home. So hopefully maybe before next time I can talk about the home cook. I'm a big believer if you go to somebody else's house for Thanksgiving and you don't necessarily get the turkey you want, that's all about the fellowship. But you should still try to bust out one good turkey a year just as a proof of skizzles. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? The three of us, we didn't talk about it, right? We didn't talk about the photo shoot we did at Food and Wine, did we?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, we did the little turkey with the gravy packet on the inside, where we took the gravy packet, made the gravy packet with gelatin, well, extra gelatin, duh, and then and calcium, cut it into blocks, threw it into alginate to put a heat-proof like thin layer around it, and then did the very finely pounded white meat turkey. Right around the gravy packet. Then we did the dark meat turkey. Then we did the skin. We did the cook-off. Then we dried off the skin. We hit it with the Searsol. And then we this is the fun part. Stas made Parker House roll dough, and I made my mom's stuffing, and we packed the stuffing, and we put the Parker House roll around it, and then we cooked that stuff up. It tastes pretty good. I mean, Piper couldn't tell because he's not allowed to,
Yeah, I could eat the crayonnaise.
Oh, Piper made crayonnaise, which registered trademark. Patent pending. Not really patent pending. Not really registered trademark either. But that's really simple. That stuff was simple. You just mixed, we made the cranberry sauce, strained out the solids, and mixed it with mayonnaise, right?
No.
What?
No.
What did you do?
I strained out the solids from the cranberry sauce, and when it was not set but still a little bit warm, I put the yolk in there.
Oh, you made it scratch. You didn't mix mayonnaise. You made it old school. Is it because I yelled at you that the guy that Bao made it, the chocolate mayonnaise back in the day, made you feel bad about it?
I mean, you set that as sort of a precedent.
Yeah. Now, I thought Piper took the easy way out, but it turns out Piper Piper did me proud and did not take the easy way out. And it was delicious. It was good.
Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it for my family, I think.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you, can you fit the recipe into Twitter? Can you get it that short?
Mm-mm.
I did a whole thing for steak once in Twitter. Style's like, no. She's looking, no.
You could do like two tweets.
No, I bet Piper can't do it in one tweet. That's what I'm saying.
Ooh.
You don't think Piper can do it in one tweet?
We're struggling with tweets right now.
What if I just wrote it down and then took a photo of it?
That's a weak tweet. That's weak tweet. Weak tweet. The whole point of the tweet is to try to get within the medium, which is the character. Well,
no,
he's going to try.
He's working outside of it. It'll be on a splattered.
Piper's going to send out this damn recipe one way or other. And in order to get it, I'm not going to put it on the Cooking Issues tweeting feed. You're going to have to go follow Booker and Dax Lab, which is where the Searsol thing is going to be going up in 2 days. Well, 2 days and like 5 hours. 2 days and like 8 hours, whatever it is. Midnight. Midnight on
2 days and 12 hours.
Thursday, Friday, Black Friday. So you want to talk about what's going on with that?
I mean, if you're following us on Twitter, you already know that we've got a lot of big names using the Searsol, loving the Searsol. And we're going to launch it. The video's coming together. The page is coming together. It looks great. I'm excited.
Yeah. You want to tell them about our sushi chef friend?
Daisuke Nakazawa?
Yeah. The famous four.
He worked at Jiro. He was the guy who made the omelet.
By the way, Stas and I have eaten at Jiro. The omelet, the tamago there, is in fact different from any other one and delicious. Remember, it was kind of fluffy and like almost like a cake. Mm-hmm. Remember that thing?
Mm-hmm.
That was actually one of my favorite things about Jiro was the tamago. Delicious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now the developer, I guess, the master of my favorite tamago now uses the Searsol.
Yeah.
Loves.
He's got a restaurant somewhere in the West Village.
Yeah, I hear it's hard to get into, though, right?
Yeah.
Hard to find.
It's on Commerce. Oh, my God. Look. People, see, here's the problem. Like, people are telling inside jokes on the radio. They were in a taxi cab with a famous chef who is known for having a bit of a temper, and the taxi driver was unable to find a Nakazawa sushi restaurant. And so there was hilarity ensued, right?
Yeah.
And by hilarity, I mean anger.
And fear. But he loves Nakazawa loves the Searsol. Doesn't put any taste on the salmon skin that he crisps up with it. It's awesome.
Well, maybe someday we can go eat some. See how that works out for us. I'd love to. All right. So,
hey, real quick before we move on, I just want for our first time listeners, I want to jump in and say, okay, so what is the Searsol? Why do we want it? Etc.
I love the idea that we might have a first time listener. I feel that we had a certain peak, and then we just lose them all. So
somebody wandered in here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like, so what is this? So a Searsol. It's a good point. Jalen. Thanks so much. The Searsol is an attachment that fits on a torch. So for years, right, if you're doing low temperature sous vide cooking, especially at home, the way I used it, honestly, the way I used to finish a steak or anything, fish, poultry, anything that I would do sous vide, deep fry. Only way, deep fry. Deep fry. Deep fry. Right? And that's crispy and delicious. Love a deep fryer. Problem is, not everyone has a commercial deep fryer in their house. I mean, I guess because of like what I said before a couple episodes ago about insurance reasons and whatnot. Some people don't like the idea of finished frying things for sous vide. They're wrong. It's delicious, but, you know, whatever. And most people don't have power output enough to heat up a pan sufficiently. So really, charcoal grill is a good option, but, you know, a lot of people can't do a charcoal grill right away, or they don't have one, or they're in an apartment or something like this. So a lot of people turn to the blowtorch. The problem with the blowtorch is it creates what we call a torch taste on the meat, which is a very, very characteristic torchy fuel taste. That you know, our friend Arielle at UC Davis did some work for us. Thank you. Where she showed that, in fact, it's not the fuel itself that's causing it, but the intense heat of the flame is creating combustion flavors on the meat itself. So we have this item called the Searsol, which plugs onto a torch. We recommend the Burnsomatic TS8000, because it's 12,000 BTUs. It plugs on this thing, and it turns it into a mini handheld IR broiler, basically. What do you think?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah? Yeah? Do I know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now for some questions. Rory Mears writes in about juice. Hey to the Cooking Issues team, my wife just bought a juicer. Not the auger type, but the type with the fine spinning blade. My question is, how can I preserve the juice for longer than a few hours? I've tried searching the Google, but I get a lot of mumbo jumbo about how you shouldn't try to preserve it because of its magical life-giving nutritional properties are so fleeting. However, I only drink the juice because it tastes good. Is that not reason enough? So what are my options to get it to last, say, 1 week? I have ascorbic acid on hand, although I have no idea what sort of percentages to use it in, and I also have a sous vide and no qualms about heating the fruit juice, heating the fruit prior to juicing, or in fact the resulting juice. I'm keen to make bulk lots of tasty fruit, apple, orange, and or veggie juice, whatever's cheap at the market on the weekend to last the week. Love the show as always. Keep it up. Regards, Rory Mearns. Okay. P.S. I'm going to read the P.S. before I answer the question because I love it. P.S. on these nuts. He goes, we happen to be listening to the episode with the rant about Virginia peanuts while driving through Virginia on our U.S. road trip holiday. I want to take a U.S. road trip holiday with my kids, but my kids would never be into it. Like, I want to do all that crap. Maybe in a year. Did you guys do that when you were kids? Take the road trip around the country?
I've done it recently, but not as a kid.
So, I'll get into it later if I have time. Like, all I'm saying is that I used to do it, and I appreciate that I did it now, but it's boring as hell to sit in the back of the car and watch a bunch of stuff go by. So, like, when we drive with the kids, like, they have their faces buried in iPhones and iPads, and, like, my wife and I are like, what the hell? Look around at this scenery. Look at this shit. Look. And then like, they don't really care. And then, like, I remember back, and I'm like, yo, Jen, that's my wife. I was like, yo, Jen, I mean, I remember not giving a crap when I was a kid, right? But you guys don't have this experience to share with me because you didn't do that.
Nope.
No.
Maybe Joe, did you do that stuff? I think he's away.
You know, not really like cross-country road trips, but, you know, we drove a couple hours here and there.
And were you bored as crap in the back?
Oh, it depends. I also get car sick, so that's kind of my main memory, feeling nauseous.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Great times.
Driving and Puking. That was that great Southern rock band. Remember that, Driving and Puking?
Yeah.
Or was it Driving and Crying? I think it was Driving and Crying.
Yeah.
Should have been Driving and Puking. Good band. Okay. We happen to be listening to the episode with the rant about Virginia peanuts while driving through Virginia on our U.S. road trip holiday. My wife said, yeah, right, how good can the peanuts really be? I don't know that your wife speaks that way, but that's just my voice when I imitate people. And it's exactly what my reaction was. Within 10 minutes of that, we stopped at some tired-looking roadside shop and picked up a can of the goods. Wow, we were both blown away. They were so insanely good, and just as you described, with an unfamiliar but satisfying snap to them. Virginia peanuts, these nuts. Okay, now back to your question. So, just one note on juices. You mentioned orange, and obviously orange, you're going to juice it in a different way. Be careful when you are juicing oranges because some oranges, specifically some navels, some tangerines, other the juice will bitter over time. So, just test a couple, and it's variety dependent. You just test it, and if after a couple of hours it hasn't gone bitter, you're probably okay. But it's just something to note on some citrus fruits, is some will undergo post juice bittering. Some tangerines, I don't know whether clementines do. I think some clementines do. A lot of navels do. Anyway, just something to be aware of. Ascorbic acid is going to be your lifesaver on a lot of these things. I wouldn't do a pre juicing heat step on it because you're not going to get mold growth that quickly on your juice in the fridge or in the freezer as long as it's not moldy to begin with. You wash it thoroughly. If you want to do a sanitized step, if you have a non-flavor, like one of those what are those things called? You ever seen those things? Those fruit sani? I've never used them.
I've never seen them.
They have them. They're like solutions you can dip like salad and stuff into if you're pregnant, and then it doesn't like. But I've never used it. Some people even use like a weak chlorine, dip it in, and then let it air out. I've never done it. Anyways, but you can do it. And juice it. Then I usually way overdose on ascorbic acid. Like way overdose on ascorbic acid. Like to the tune of about a teaspoon per liter, right? Would you say that's about what we do, Pipes?
Yeah, it's a lot. It doesn't add too much flavor.
It does juice you up on vitamin C so you can, pee yellow and maybe live forever. Although Linus Pauling did not live forever. Linus Pauling was the famous 2-time Nobel laureate scientist the second one he won was a Peace Prize, but he thought you could greatly increase longevity and reduce disease by just mega dosing on vitamin C. You know what happened to him?
He peed out a bunch of vitamin C and then died?
That's pretty accurate. Although he did live to a ripe old age and was, one of the smartest scientists of the 20th century. Anyway, so there you go, Linus Pauling. So anyways, so I usually add about a teaspoon per liter and stir it in. And if you want to keep it for a long time, I would say cold, vac bag it, and then freeze it. When you do it, the best way to freeze it is to vac bag the juice and then lay it on a sheet tray and freeze it flat in a sheet, and that way they stack very well in your freezer. And also, when it comes time to thaw them, you're only thawing through, you know, like, I don't know, like 3/8 of an inch to, you know, 3/8 of an inch roughly is what we usually do them at. 3/8 of an inch of stuff you have to thaw out in running water in order to get the juice usable again. So that's what I would recommend. And juice lasts a good week in the fridge. Depends on the juice too. I mean, like grapefruit juice, what do you think? Weak Piper? Nah. Orange juice, couple days.
Couple grapefruit. Days.
Freeze it.
Freeze it.
Yeah, freeze it. Flat. In vacs.
Yeah.
You're good. Apple juice would last a good week.
Oh, yeah.
It's not, I don't think you're going to get mold. Piper would add, what would you add to as a preservative if you really want to keep that sucker?
Sodium benzoate. Potassium sorbate.
It's small amounts.
It's super micro, like 1/100.
Yeah, but you only need a small bit because you're really only preventing the slightest. Look, you're not trying to keep this sucker, you know, yeast-proof in a shelf-stable application over like a zillion years. You're talking about keeping this sucker in the fridge for a week. So yeah. The amount of stabilization, you know, you need is minimal.
I wouldn't. I mean, if you're doing it for a week, I wouldn't put anything in. But if you were going to have it on the shelf, I mean, you want to prevent against microbial growth. And
yeah, but you remember, there's also they're not carbonating it. So, like when you're doing benzoate in a soda application, which is what Piper's done most of the research on, you know, the carbon dioxide is also a huge inhibitor.
Right.
But anyway,
and whatever. So is actually the ascorbic acid is a huge inhibitor too. It's really going to protect it.
Yeah, but it doesn't last. But it'll last a week.
Yeah.
Ascorbic acid doesn't last over time. It gets used and then it's over. But I also agree that I think, you know, you're right on point. I only drink the juice because it tastes good. That is reason enough. I don't believe in any magical life-giving nutritional properties. Although I was teaching a bunch of kids at Dax's third grade class, and this one kid, he asked me, he's like, do they make any machines that use juice as a fuel? I was like, you are a machine that uses juice as a fuel, my friend. Third graders are awesome. Anyway. I was explaining steam engines.
I love it when they learn about food.
Yeah.
Young.
Yeah, young. Juice. Okay. Next, what was that? Was that an okay answer, Stas?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're just like, I don't care. Matt from Chicago writes in, also about nuts. Not these, but just some nuts. Hello, Dave, and all the people who can, unlike Dave, occasionally be absent without thereby causing the whole show to skip a week. Ouch. Wow. Oh, Stas, have you ever missed one?
Have we?
Have you ever missed one?
No.
Mm-mm. I think I feel like I've done it once without you. Mm-mm. I think, I don't know. We'll have to look it up. Okay. You mentioned on this week's episode a desire for a nut question every week. You were probably being facetious, but nevertheless, I'm here to do my part. Now, I like nut questions. Right, Pius?
Yeah.
And we got another one after this, too.
Awesome.
Two more nut questions if we get to them. Awesome. Anyway, I seem to remember in one of your early episodes a brief reference to a book which covered methods for making not merely actual tofu, but very tofu-like products from things other than soy, such as nuts. Speaking to someone who's allergic to soy and all emanations thereof, but nevertheless interested in experimenting with tofu-esque ingredients in the kitchen, I've searched through the archives. It's been unable to identify which episode this was, let alone which book, so I'll just come out and ask. What information sources would you recommend for someone in my situation? Am I merely hallucinating this discussion from the show's past? Is there any consumer intelligent home cook oriented literature which provide a useful guide to the production of fofu? I like fofu as a term. Matt from Chicago-ish. P.S. I feel sorry for whatever poor, deluded, misguided persons wanted to remove your pro gear from your old apartment kitchen. I, for one, would happily pay a premium for such a kitchen. Stas is like, you're preaching to the converted over here. Okay. So the here's the thing, Matt. I did talk about that, and my thought was that it's in modernist cuisine, in the, you know, the massive tome that is modernist cuisine. Here is the problem. As I spoke last week, I moved apartments, and all of my books are still in boxes, so I didn't get a chance to go to the book and search it. But my recollection is that modernist cuisine has a section not merely on reforming tofu with transglutaminase, but also on making alternative tofus from other legumes and other things like that. Now, it's extremely obvious that you can get tofu-like textures from almost anything you want, any nut milk you want, by setting it with the appropriate agents. But I assume that's not what you're talking about. I assume you're talking about making an actual tofu-like product that uses a coagulation as the technique. Now, I myself have experimented with peanuts, and the result was delicious, but the texture was crap. It was worthless, useless. Like, I tried it only one time. It also clogged. It wouldn't coagulate hard enough, so it clogged my draining, my draining towels. And also, my Nguyen tofu book also packs. All my tofu references are packed. Actually, I found Shirtleaf, but he doesn't believe in any of that stuff anyway. Next week, hopefully, I have the books unpacked and I can address it again with the tofu. But my guess is that if you took a protein, like something like peanuts, and tried to make a peanut foo, and you added transglutaminase, when I was doing my experiments was well before I had started working with transglutaminase. This is like 2000. This is like 2000. You know, when I was doing this stuff, and it's like 12, 13 years ago or something. So I need to revisit it maybe with transglutaminase. I'm sure you could get peanuts to set harder with if you use TG. Wouldn't you think, Pipes?
Yeah, I've gotten milk to set with it in a centrifuge.
I'm assuming, I don't know, Matt, whether you have a centrifuge or not, but we'll...
Well, I'm sorry.
Piper's like, just put it in your centrifuge. What are you, jerk? What are you? Man. Piper. Okay.
Should we take a break?
Really?
Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll come back from the break with more cooking issues.
So far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Hell yes! Cooking Issues! Love that song! Love that song!
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef.
Love that stuff. We need to get, you know what? The people, you don't know this guy yet. Maybe you've heard Nastasha speak about him. But Phil Bravo, a friend of ours, kind of a friend of the show. Not really a friend of the show. Friend of Nastasha's. The person that...
Enemy of the show.
That Nastasha... Yeah, you know, currently an enemy of the show. Nastasha and Piper fed Jerusalem artichokes to mess with his insides. He has possibly one of the great radio voices of all times. And he was supposed to come in to the... show today and read the questions for Thanksgiving. His voice, when he wants it to be, is a dead ringer for Thurl Ravencroft, who you might know as the voice of Tony the Tiger. In fact, yesterday Phil did a "They're Great," which was
amazing.
I almost fell over. I've heard that he does, like a life-changing Mr. Grinch rendition. By the way, I don't want anyone calling in and saying that the Grinch is Boris Karloff. Look, the voice of the Grinch is Boris Karloff, right? Right, but Thurl Ravencroft is the song, right? And that's why it sounds different. That's why the song sounds different from the voice.
Well, the song is in second person, and the Grinch is typically in first person.
Whoa, with the analysis, correct, from creative writing major Piper Christensen. Anyway, so like I can't wait for the extremely short Christmas season this year so that I can hear Phil Bravo do his rendition of "You're a Foul One, Mr. Grinch." The reason I brought that up is because I would love to hear Phil's rendition of Hearst Ranch Grass-Fed Beef.
Yeah.
The authentic taste of the American West, right? Yeah. Isn't that what it is? I believe it's the authentic taste of the American West. Is that true?
As authentic as it gets.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Oh, speaking of which, another one of our sponsors, I have from Underground Meats, I have something in. This is from Brandon Hopkins in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, all. Thanks for the salami recommendations a few weeks ago. I ordered the Tuscan salami supersata. I would call it, you know what? I'm from here, so I'll call it supersata. Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. Right? But how do you pronounce it, Stas? How's the actual Italian thing?
Supersata.
Supersata. Oh, supersata. All right. Finocchiona, right? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Fennel sausages, salami. And the Spanish chorizo from Underground Meats. Underground Meats. Underground Meats. Everyone that tried them thought they were delicious. The Spanish chorizo was particularly tasty, which I served with manchego and quince paste on some toasted baguettes. You were all right, Piper, until he busted out the baguettes. You were all good until he busted out the... You like membrillo?
Love membrillo.
Yeah? Nice. Why don't you point the mic towards your face when you talk? It's because he's shoving his face with food. That's all right. Don't worry about it. Anyway, I like membrillo as well. Quince paste on some toasted baguettes. All the sausages were far superior to anything I have had in the store. I thought you'd be happy to know how awesome the show's sponsor is. Not only was all their sausage delicious, but their delivery was very fast. I would recommend any sausage fans give Underground Meats a try. Thanks for the suggestion, Brandon Hopkins. That's good. That's a good testimonial, right? Yeah, good people. Good people there. Anyway. And while we're on the subject of meats, Lucas, friend of the show, writes in, and friend of MOFAD, came to the MOFAD party. He's going to give us the deer meat. He also had a comment on the breastfeeding. We have two comments on the breastfeeding thing. And surprisingly, most people – look, before we get into this, like, I'm not saying that someone should, like, shove the stuff in your face necessarily. I'm just saying, you know, don't be hating. Don't be hating, right? That's my point. No?
No.
All right, whatever. All right. So Lucas wants to give us some of his deer meat, which we desperately want. We're going to, like, 54 Eldridge is our lab, by the way, on Elder Street between Canal and Hester. Like, we're not available, though, until after Thanksgiving. So we'll have to get the deer meat some point after Thanksgiving.
I already told him.
But he writes, for the record, I think women should be able to breastfeed however they want, albeit the usage of the scarf should be is a matter of good taste. Rather than of policy, right? I think that's the point. It's not making a policy, but it is, I guess, good taste, right? I think we can agree on
that. I saw a lady in a business meeting, though, bare breastfeeding.
Okay. Were you observing this? He goes,
at Roberta's, yes.
So then Lucas adds, however, as you sit in the center of Hipsteropolis, which is a good word, I don't think you can demand too much good taste.
That is true.
Wow. Whoa. And while we're on it, we had another comment in on that. Might as well go to that. Dr. Bob writes in, "Hi, Anastasia. For some of us, the female body is the pinnacle of creation and should be treated with the utmost respect. When I examine a breast in an emergency department exam room, it's done only with a female staffer in attendance. When it's not being examined, the breast is kept respectfully tucked away in the exam gown, even though the patient is in a private room. I realize cultural norms vary around the world, but in a New York restaurant with a wide variety of public in attendance, I agree that the respectful thing, particularly for the woman in question, is to keep the breast covered. The awe and mystery of the female form is worthy of preservation. Dr. Bob."
Thanks, Dr. Bob.
Well, that's the first time. I love the way you said that, Stas. Thanks, Dr. Bob.
It's awkward.
Yeah. Well, you're the one that brought it up. You can't bring something like that up and then...
No, I know. I appreciate it. It's still awkward.
All right. Awkward! Right? That's like... same. Alex from Santa Barbara writes in, "Hello, Dave and Nastasha, and I guess Piper, even though, you know, Alex didn't include you.
Nobody knew. It's
implied.
The implied Piper? Is that's the next thing, the implied Piper? I will skip the fryer talk, because we were talking about fryers, and ask about Thanksgiving. I've been working on a pecan pie. Pecan or pecan? What do you get? Pecan. Are you a pecan or a pecan?
Pecan.
Pecan? A pecan. But I think everyone down there goes pecan, right? Pecan? Yeah. Mm. What about Baltimore? You're on the dividing line between the North and the South. What do you say?
I say pecan.
Yeah?
But pecan sounds like toucan.
Ooh, Toucan Sam.
Yeah.
You know what really ticks me off? They have a new Fruit Loops thing that has this like weird center goop in it. I haven't tried it. My kids have been pestering me, but it hasn't gone on sale yet. So I have. We're talking about Fruit Loops, is what we're talking about, Piper. I don't eat cereal. I come from Vermont. So the they have this new Fruit Loops, and the old advertisement for Fruit Loops was "Follow your nose, it always knows." And like the Toucan Sam goes around. But this new one, they're using freaking metal detectors to find the Fruit Loops. Toucan Sam is there with his toucan minions and a freaking metal detector. Why do you need a metal detector to find Fruit Loops? Follow your nose, Sam. It always knows. Gosh.
What's with the fruit goop in the
center? I don't know, man. I don't know. Like, I don't know, man.
It's metallic?
They're finding the treasure chest. I don't know what the hell's going on with it. First of all, it's a fruit loop, not a fruit pillow. And second of all, the freaking toucan with his giant nose and all the color stripes is supposed to be able to smell any dang fruit loop product from a mile away. And the fact that maybe he's so old, his nose is shot, he has to use a metal detector to find it. Get your advertising straight. That irritated the heck out of me. And then, even worse, my kids saw that and then they still wanted it because they didn't realize what a slap in the face it was to toucans everywhere that they had to use some sort of electronic gimmickry to find the Fruit Loops. Jerks. Okay. I will skip the fire talking back to Alex. And that's about Thanksgiving. I've been working on a pecan pie-inspired dessert for Thanksgiving, kind of like a peanut butter cup but with pecans. The flavors are great once sugar, oil, and molasses are added, but the texture is off. I can't get the crumbly, moist, dense texture that the mad scientists at Reese's pull off. Any ideas? Listen, Alex from Santa Barbara. So the trick with – when you're trying to imitate somebody else's texture, the best thing to do is to figure out kind of how they make it, right? Now, I know I've mentioned on the show before that one of the key notes in a real Reese's peanut butter cup is rancidity, is, you know, oxidative rancidity of the peanut butter. And I know I mentioned at some point, I don't know how long ago, that I spoke to someone from a company that does oxygen scavenging packaging that prevents rancidity in packaged goods. And they did a test run of Reese's peanut butter cups with the oxygen scavengers in them. And nobody liked them because they missed the taste of rancidity. Right? So anyway, so you might want to let the pecans go rancid before you make it if you really want it. If you really want to hit that Reese's note right on the button. But what I recommend you do is go look up a copycat recipe for Reese's. Now, Nastasha looked up. There's a well-known copycat recipe dude named Todd Wilbur. He has YouTube videos, I think, and he has a show, and he has a couple books on copycat recipes. He tackled Reese's, and... And what he uses, his trick supposedly, is to use reduced fat peanut butter and powdered sugar. So he's using fundamentally reduced fat peanut butter and powdered sugar. Now, luckily for you, the pecans that you get in general have my guess is from having ground a lot of pecan butter over the years. Remember, Stas, we used to have to grind pecan butter constantly. Stas has got that thank Christ that part of my life is over smile on her face, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we hated that. I hated doing that. We had to do it all the time. We used to just do pecans constantly. Pecan oil, pecan butter, pecan soups, all in the centrifuges. Pecans, pecans, pecans. Now, Stas is going to be reliving that nightmare with hickory nuts. When are we going to get those things in?
Super soon.
Okay. So they, and we're going to test butternuts too. But
you
I don't know whether.
The guy from Home Depot?
We found a guy in Home Depot. Literally, we're in the plant section. Nastasha's in the plant section because, like, I'm going to go get some bulbs for my house. I'm like, what the? And then she's there, and she's like, come here, come here. And, like, this guy is over in the corner talking about, I got all these hickory nuts in my yard, and I hear that some people on the internet, they like these things, so I collected them. And I'm thinking I'd sell them, but I don't really know how. And Stas's like, we can buy them. We can buy all of the hickory nuts. Right? Isn't that what you said to him?
Hyperductive, yeah.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't talk. But you forced him to. But it was you. You both overheard him, I guess. Yeah. That's when we were picking up our freeze dryer from Ideas and Food. Ideas and Food. We have a freeze dryer from that. We haven't had a chance to fire it up yet. I've been working on the Searzol, so I haven't had a chance to fire up the freeze dryer. After Thanksgiving, we'll fire up the freeze dryer and give you guys reports. Anyways.
Hey, Dave, I got to jump in here for a second. So a listener just sent in to info@heritageradionetwork.org a picture of Krusty O's from The Simpsons that comes with a free jagged metal Krusty O inside, and saying that maybe Toucan Sam is looking for Krusty O's.
Maybe. I mean, that's why he needs the metal detector to find the jaggedy metal one.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I was just impressed at the speed at which that came in. I guess it's live radio, right?
Yeah, we're live. We're live.
We're live.
When I say coming to you live, I'm not messing around.
No way.
No, we're actually here, real human beings, coming to you live. Okay, so his secret is to use the reduced fat peanut butter. My guess from grinding a lot of pecans over the years is that because we would typically, to get a good oil yield out of the pecans, we would add some oil back to it. Remember that, Stas? Because yeah. They would they're not as dry as almonds, but they're more dry than probably peanuts. Definitely peanut butter that has oil added to it. So if you grind straight pecans, or I guess you're using pecan butter. And then you got to get your molasses and whatever else you do to the texture of a powdered sugar. I mean, that's going to be the issue. They don't make a how would you do that? Just use brown sugar and powder it, right? So you don't have the extra moisture content. Just powderize brown sugar in a Roboku with some other dry stuff. Freeze and powder it. Like, how are you going to powder brown sugar? Get the free running brown.
Mortar and pestle it.
What's gonna? No, it's gonna
with
gum
some
up.
Starch.
Get the free running brown, maybe.
Oh, demerara.
Yeah, and then powderize it in a blender, and then maybe add some cornstarch to it because that cornstarch that's in the powdered sugar might be helping out a little bit. Mm-hmm. You don't know what the ratio of cornstarch in powdered sugar is, do you?
No, it's not huge, though.
No, it's like a couple percent, right?
Yeah.
So the cornstarch is probably helping with the texture a little bit, right, because it's giving it that pasty, mm-hmm. right? And then powderize the brown sugar substitute, and then just make sure the fat content of your pecans aren't too high, and that should be getting the texture you want. And if you want, check out Todd Wilber's whatever, his website. But it looks like you're going to reduce the oil, and what do you think? Tell me whether it works. I am interested to hear the result because until I found hickory nuts, my feeling was pecans were God's nut. But now I think hickory nuts are God's nut. Right? God's nut. Philippe Lament writes in about possibly poisoned bread. Hello, Dave, Nastasha, Jack, and Joe, and Piper. This is Philippe Lament writing in. Thanks for the advice on the soft serve machine. I recently went on vacation and ate at a spectacular restaurant called Amas in Copenhagen. I've never been. I was in Copenhagen for like 13 minutes, and I took a train to Sweden. Got the hell out. I've never been to any of those restaurants. Right? Amas is in Copenhagen, yeah? Yeah, it's in Copenhagen. Yeah. Anyway. There we were served a bread made with 1/3 fermented cooked potato. We were told – I like the word potato. Potato. We were told that the potatoes were cooked, mashed, and put in cryovac bags and fermented in a warm room. The bread was amazing, but wouldn't this anaerobic and warm environment create a poison? What's up? Thank you. Well, yes, it most likely could. So this is very similar to salt rising bread, sometimes made with a potato starter. There's a lot of anaerobic fermentation of potatoes in Andean cooking, where the potato comes from. Some of their freeze dried chuño potatoes are kept in water and fermented. And there's also something called togash, which is like you bury the potatoes in water for like months, and then you dig it up, and then I think they say that they use running water, so it takes the bacteria away. But you and I both know that that's not the case. So what's going to grow in there? So the two main things that you're going to get growing, and in fact, salt rising bread, the actual rising is not done by a yeast. It's done by your good buddy Clostridium perfringens, and that is not good. You do not want to get a perfringens infection, especially if you're a soldier in battle, because that causes gangrene, which is bad, and it also creates an enterotoxin, which can get you sick. So all in all, bad. But the good news is that when you cook bread, you're cooking it up to the boiling point of water, typically to 12 or higher, right? Because it's getting at least to 180 Fahrenheit, usually up higher, up closer to the boiling point. And well before that happens, the toxins from the bacteria themselves are killed. The spores can't germinate because the moisture activity of the bread is not high enough when it's done. And the because you might not be killing the spores, remember, because that takes a much higher temperature than that for a long period of time, because Clostridium perfringens is a spore-forming bacteria. But the toxins are neutralized, the vegetative cells are killed, and the spores cannot germinate in the environment of the cooked bread. So salt-rising bread, safe. Also interesting, I read some papers on the line, on the internets, that say that the other problem, and this you can get this from a poorly stored baked potato, botulism, right? Botulism can grow, and there's been cases of poorly stored people eating baked potatoes that have botulism and can cause problems. So the good news is that if you're specifically growing Clostridium perfringens will outcompete the botulism, and there's been studies showing that Clostridium will not grow in the presence of a thriving perfringens colony. So that will take care of that. And the other good news is, let's say you should grow a boatload of botulism. The toxin, the botulism toxin, is also heat labile and will be destroyed by the cooking. So in general, it seems that you're not going to die from eating the properly made stuff. And my experience from making salt rising bread and from having Clostridium fermented cassava in Senegal was that it has a very characteristic smell to it, and so you kind of know whether or not it's got the right bacterial mix in there when you're eating it, when you're making it rather, and so hopefully that stuff should guarantee that you're not going to die. And apparently you did not, because you wrote us a question, right? What do you think?
Yeah. Solved.
Good. It's a good, but with all of the BS, I am not a food safety, blah blah blah. Like, don't do this at home, blah 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 blah. Okay, we had a question in from Joe Blow 67. I can't believe there's only 67. He must have been an early Joe Blow, because like that's like one of the first ones you're gonna check, right? I'm sure it's like up to like Joe Blow 8,925,326. Anyway. Any ideas for what you can do with peanut shells? Seems like a giant waste to eat the inner nut and throw the rest out. Well, you should just throw it on the floor.
Yeah, like a Western bar.
Yeah, right? Because like that like totally adds to the what's it called, right?
The ambiance?
Yeah, ambiance.
The ambiance.
The ambiance of the bar. Take this seriously. Like, they don't taste good, right? But I don't know. Okay, so you guys are like a little bit younger than I am. So when I say peanut, you say, like, name a person. Name a person who's worked with peanuts. I'm going to see if it was only when I was a kid that they were teaching this stuff.
People who feed elephants?
No. George Washington Carver, man. When I was a kid, if you said the word Carver or George Washington Carver, you're peanut, you know what I mean? If you said peanuts, you're like, George Washington Carver, billion ways to use a peanut. You know what I mean? So George Washington Carver was, like, at least in the 70s, we were like taught constantly about, there was this guy who his life's work was he's going to figure out how to like squeeze every last piece of utility out of the freaking peanut. Turns out the guy also worked on sweet potatoes and a bunch of other stuff. He was the head of the agricultural department at the Tuskegee Institute for many years, starting at the beginning of the 1900s all the way through, I think until his death. He did write a book that you can get online, portions of it at least, called How to Grow the Peanut and 105 Ways of Preparing It for Human Consumption. And this is not about the hulls, but you should go check it out. He did a lot of patent work on like different ways to use peanuts, like making textiles out of peanuts, and that's where the hull comes in, making like ointments out of peanuts, medicines out of peanuts, oils out of peanuts. People say George Washington Carver invented peanut butter. That's a load of crap. That is not the case. Although he might have done a lot to popularize peanut butter here in the US of A. And again, the French hate peanut butter. Maybe it's because they have something against George Washington Carver. Weasels. But very interesting story. You should go read about George Washington Carver. Born a slave, became an eminent scientist. Anyway, so the one that I like of his is, and then I'll answer your question. Here's a weird one. Number 43 in the peanut uses is peanut and cheese roast. Ready for this?
Yeah.
I want someone to make this. Like maybe Piper, someday after the Kickstarter is done, you can make this, right? 1 cup grated cheese. No freaking specification of what kind of cheese. Now, this is like 1910 or whatever, so, you know, whatever. Maybe we'll have to figure out kind of what kind of cheese they would have had, like just lying around. Okay, you will use cheddar and tell us. Okay, 1 cup breadcrumbs. You have to substitute gluten-free breadcrumbs, right? So you got your 1 cup grated cheese, your 1 cup of breadcrumbs, your teaspoon of chopped onion, your 1 cup of finely ground peanuts, tablespoon butter, juice of half of a lemon. This is a weird recipe, right?
Just going off the deep end a little bit.
Salt to taste. Cook the onion in the butter and a little water until it's tender. That's random right there. Like adding water to sweat the onion out before the butter. That's random stuff right there. Random.
Yeah.
Mix the other ingredients and moisten with water, more water, using the water in which the onion has been cooked. Pour into a shallow baking dish and brown in the oven. That is a weird, weird recipe.
Sounds like a dip.
No, he says it's a roast.
I mean,
he says it sets into a block. He doesn't say whether to serve it hot or serve it cold. I mean, that's a crazy recipe. He says cook onion in butter and water. So why add the butter then? And why not just add the butter later? And then mix breadcrumbs, peanuts, lemon, and cheese together with the water and onion stuff and bake it. That's weird.
Yeah, it's strange.
But you know what? You know, George Washington.
Try it.
Yeah, I'm going to try it. I'm going to give George Washington Carver a try. But to answer your question, the only thing I can think of that's useful from a food perspective is you can make charcoal from peanuts, so shells. So you take the peanut shells, pack them into a chimney starter, light them up, and then to make charcoal, you have to cut off the entire oxygen supply. Once the stuff starts burning, you cut off the oxygen supply. They should go to charcoal. Most people, when they're actually using it for fuel, then compress them into briquettes, and you can look up online how to do this. I wonder whether there's a use for the really fine charcoal, maybe as a really quick way to start charcoal, right? I mean, it's going to burn really quickly or burn really hot, or maybe throw it on top of charcoal to give an extra burst of heat. I don't know. But it's the only thing I can think of from a food perspective.
It's like a fuel for a smoker, maybe? Just not charcoal, but like regular shells. I don't know. I don't know what their smoke tastes like.
I don't know, but that's a good point, Piper. I like the way you think. I like the way you think. There's a lot of people who are considering using it in places that don't have a lot of wood and that, you know, can't afford other things. You know what I mean? Although, it's an awful lot of peanuts to be cooking from the hulls. But anyway, so maybe someone will give it a try and test it out. Okay. Tristan Catcher writes in, making a Chev sorbet, cream cheese and Chev and syrup, churning it as normal. It's freezing smooth when it's fresh, but overnight it goes solid. How should I stabilize it? I don't think you're adding enough sugar. Mm-hmm. You need to increase the sugar level on it. What I would do if you don't want it to be sweet is to use a low sugar sweetener like glucose syrup, which has a DE of like, what, it's like 40.
I think it's like 43. 40,
yeah, 40 something, like low DE glucose syrup, which is going to have a very low sweetness level. There are even less sweet things out there, but that are going to give you the bodying effect you need and the softening effect you need. If it's an actual stabilization problem, I like LBG, locust bean gum, for that kind of an application. So you just cook the whole thing out with the – add the LBG cold, disperse into hopefully water or whatever, and then cook it out above about 85, bring it back down. If you add eggs, I guess you didn't, and then it's a sorbet. So anyway, that should stabilize it and prevent any stabilization problems you have from a texture. But solidity is almost always a sugar balance problem. Would you agree on that?
Yeah.
If you don't want to add more sugar, another thing you could do, some people do, they add alcohol to soften it. I don't actually like to do that because the it melts weirdly when you add a lot of alcohol to a sorbet. Like it's like holding together and then all of a sudden it's not holding together anymore. It doesn't have the same meltdown that you get from kind of the sugar inhibition melting. At least that's been my experience in life. What about you, Pipes? You feel it the same way or no?
I haven't had too many alcohol.
We have a caller.
Oh, we have a caller?
Sorbets.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. How's it going? It's JD.
Hey, we're doing all right. What's up?
Hey, I'm doing all right. I just have some questions in terms of I'm actually helping the Maine Street Kitchen folks. They recently opened their restaurant.
Oh, yeah. How's it doing? Like those people. How's it going?
Yeah, it's doing pretty well. I'm actually trying to help them with some a circulator issue they have in terms of being able to do some 64 degree C eggs in 60 minutes. And I was wondering, in terms of capacity of being able to, say, run one circulator and... I'm wondering how many eggs you could run to be able to meet that 60-minute limit. if we do the preheat.
You're doing a 64?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the good news on 64 is it's a lot easier to hit 64 than it is to hit 63, right? So the easiest one is 62 because you don't need to ever get the center up to 62. 64, you need to get it at 64, but if it goes a little bit over, like 2/10, 3/10, it's not a big deal. But why do you only have 1 hour to do it?
In terms of just being able to understand the turn time and be able to prep for service, and that's typically what they're used to. So I guess the better question would be, you know, trying to maximize the amount of eggs for one circulator in a certain duration. So
yeah, I mean, go ahead.
So I guess that's kind of basically I want to be able to maximize the amount of throughput of eggs in a set amount of time.
Right.
So what I had noticed is that, you know, they were trying to do a 60-minute eggs, and they were doing, and they were telling me that it was taking a little bit longer than they expected, and basically what I determined is that they weren't preheating the water higher than, so what would happen is that they'd have to wait, for 60 eggs, they had to wait 20 minutes for recovery to get back to 64.
Yeah, and 64, you need to be at 64 to get a 64. So, I mean, a trick that, you know, that a lot of people do is, especially if you're doing something like a creme anglaise, it's really high temperature for a circulator, like, you know, 80, 82. They'll set it to 85, drop the stuff in, and within a couple of seconds, it drops down. So you can, like, overheat the water. You have to figure out kind of, You have to do some checking, some math. I mean, it doesn't take that long to overcook the white on the inside, so it can be a little problematic, you know, ramping the temperature high enough to really get back fast enough. Another thing you can do is first of all, when you're cooking eggs to a specific temperature like 64, that's harder than 62 but easier than 63 in terms of difficulty, not in terms of texture. You have to make sure that the eggs aren't piled such that the eggs in the very center aren't getting proper water circulation around them or it's just not going to be cooked right. So one of the things that's going to limit the amount of eggs that you can cook is how many layers you can fit where you get water circulation between all the layers of eggs. Like, so that's critical, right? It's to get water circulation between all the layers of eggs if you want them all to cook at the same rate. The second thing you can do, and this is – I've done this before – just keep a pot of boiling water near the eggs, and then you just add boiling water by the pan full until, because that will level out right away, and you can get a sense for kind of how long it takes you to get back up, and you can bail water out, and then if you go over, you can throw a couple of ice cubes in, and you should be able to stabilize the temperature within like 3-4 minutes, you know what I mean? If you have boiling water, you should be able to get a fairly stable temperature within 3-4 minutes. Now, as to how many I've ever done at once with one circulator, usually what I'll do is, I mean, I've done 62s in very non-ideal circumstances where I've done like 100, you know, or more in one shot. It's not ideal, but with 62 you can get away with it. With 64, I don't know if you can really get away with that. I mean, I would probably say maybe, a flat is what, 36 in a flat?
Yeah.
Is that right? No, 20. What's in a flat?
6x6.
6x6, 36. 1, 2, 3 flat. Yeah, you could probably do 3 flats.
Okay.
Probably. Yeah. But, you know, the other thing you can really do, and it makes could make your life a lot easier, is to run a cycle and then chill them down, run a cycle, chill them down, and then just retherm them all at service temps. Retherm them at like 50, 55, 50, 56, and then you can just keep them around. There's no need to cook them all at once. If you actually have the time, you can cook them beforehand and then therm them up for service. And they only need like 30 – 35, 40 minutes at 55 to retherm enough for service, and then they can hold at a temperature that low at like 55, 56, even up to 57 really, they can hold for, hours and hours and hours and hours. They're not going to change their texture at that temperature. You know what I mean? And that might be a good solution for them.
Okay. So I had kind of a follow-up question because in terms of the circulation, I was thinking about building, say, a custom basket to be able to get the circulation you need, you know, basically like wire stacks. And I was wondering, you know, how effective do you think that would be, as well as what do I need to keep in mind in terms of, you know, keeping it food safe and not, you know, if I wanted to get materials, you know, what would you suggest that would best suit that?
Well, I mean, you're going to make it out of what? Out of metal? Out of stainless?
Yeah, I was thinking stainless. You know, I'm not sure. I was going to maybe try to, you know, maybe throw some fire baskets in, something of that nature, and stack some, you know, wire racks in between somehow.
Fryer baskets rust like a demon. In my experience, they're not as stainless as you would like them to be. I think a lot of them are actually just chromed over. You know what I mean? And so, like, they tend to rust. And even most cooking grates that are supposedly stainless, like, they rust out in the circ over a long period of time. But, you know, they might last a while. If I was going to do full custom job, I would do stainless or – I mean, I would do stainless. The other alternative would be acrylic or polycarb because you're not cooking at that high a temperature and you're not using alcohol. I mean, if you're not a believer in polycarb because you're worried about things leaching out if someone cleans it with detergents and starts breaking down the polycarbonate, you could go with acrylic. Acrylic's easy because you can laser cut acrylic, so if you can build something that way, but it's going to be heavier and more fragile. I mean, stainless is kind of ideal, like wirework stainless, but then you have to find someone who can do the wirework stainless for you. You could make something with fryer baskets, but when people load eggs into fryer baskets, they tend to glom together in the middle, and then the ones in the middle are going to have problems. What no one's really built that would be super sweet is something that mimics a flat of eggs, but it's just made out of like empty wire and then holds the eggs and then has a way to stack the next flat on top of it so that every egg is in its own little cage. That would be freaking genius. Like, I would buy that. Like, if you made that, I would buy that. In fact, I should make that. If you're not going to make it, I'll make that. I won't because I don't have time, but I'm saying, like, I would buy that. Wouldn't you buy that, Piper?
Yeah, we'll get some coat hangers and rubber bands.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my God. No, but, like, the thing is, like you want to fit it into, you know, like, you don't want to be using a full-size Lexan for that. You want to fit it in the half-size Lexan, right? Because, you know, anytime you cook enough eggs where you need a full-size Lexan, your recovery time is going to be ridiculous. So I would build something to maximize the tall half Lexans is what I would go for.
Is Teflon something that you can use or no?
Teflon? Good luck. Yeah. Teflon is, first of all, extremely expensive. You know, it's kind of flexible. It's impossible to join. So you have to do everything with screw fasteners and, like, I've never machined Teflon, but I don't know how easy it is to machine. It's really expensive, man. Really. Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't play the Teflon game.
Okay, you know? And then in terms of just a quick final one, in terms of watching circulation, I posted to you about putting glitter in the water, and you said that was a pain in the ass to clean. Is it doable?
Yeah.
Do you have other suggestions to be able to watch circulation and make sure that it's working properly?
I mean, like, you can just throw one or two floaty craps into it and just watch them go around. You know what I mean? Like, because that always happens anyway. In fact, like, I'm always like, what the hell fell in this bath? And then you have to, like, kind of scoop it out, and you can get a good feeling for what's going on. But literally, like, one or two little thingamajigs in there is enough to see kind of how the flow works. You can dump. I mean, like, Piper, what would you want to dump in if you were going to dump something that you had to recover later?
It's got to be big enough so it's not going to get sucked into your circulator.
Or small enough that it can get sucked through without a problem. I'll never forget the time that I didn't cheesecloth my circulator, and I did, I threw the wood chips in to do the wood chip circulator to get the flavor of the wood. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my God. It was such a nightmare. Oh, such a freaking nightmare. But the oil was good. I mean, that's a good technique, circulating charred wood chips in oil for an oil poach. I mean, it's a good technique. But but it was a pain to clean out, let me tell you.
All right. Okay, well, that answers all my questions. Thanks for everything, and keep up the good work.
Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving. All right, we actually, we have to go out now. But Elliot Papineau wrote in on the Twitter, can you debunk some stock mythology? Because the New York Times just did something on turkey stock. I don't have time to go into all of it now because they're going to kick us off. Maybe we'll do some of it on the Twitter later on. But turkey stock is that the only Thanksgiving question we've had?
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, should you cook – we'll just handle this one. Should you cook your stock covered or uncovered? And I'm going to go ahead and say that the only reason to cook a stock uncovered is so that you don't have the problem of it going to a rolling boil without you noticing it, right? Otherwise, you would want to keep it covered because that's going to keep the aromatics in more. Piper, agree or disagree?
Agree.
Yeah. So like once you get the thing set and you can ensure that you're not going to get a rolling boil in it, there's no dang point. Well, the other thing is like a lot of people – when you let's say you were at the French Culinary Institute, which you were, Piper, right? Mm-hmm. So when they taught you how to make stocks at the French Culinary Institute, what did they do that I hate?
Well, I mean they made an enormous amount at a time.
Yeah, and the bones and meat to water ratio was, in my opinion, way the hell off, right? They made a weak stock.
I don't think I can come out on the radio and say that.
No, I don't mean it in a bad way. They would then reduce it later.
Yeah, they would always make a higher water volume and then reduce it later.
Yeah, I'm much more from the James Peterson school. Great. Do people still read that stuff? He's a great cookbook writer. From his school, which is, you know, don't overwater it to begin with to minimize the amount of reduction you have to do later. And that's the kind of the school of thought I'm in. So if you're starting with a high water content and you're doing a stock where you're cooking it for a long time, and I frankly don't think turkey stock needs to be cooked that long like you do like the old ones. I just don't. I think a lot of people spend way too much time cooking their poultry stocks. You should really use a pressure cooker anyway. So I think they overwater it and then let it reduce some as it's cooking in the pot. I think that's useless, unnecessary. Just add the amount of water that you want and then cover it, ensure it doesn't go to a rolling boil. And the reason you don't want a rolling boil is you don't want to emulsify the oils into it as it's going and cause it to get cloudier, which doesn't make a damn bit of difference if you're going to make a gravy out of it, frankly.
Right.
Right?
But they also let them rip overnight too. So they want
which you're not going to do at home.
Yeah.
Whatever. I think you can cover it. That's my feeling.
Cover it and then reduce it later if you want to.
Yeah. Anyway, happy Thanksgiving. Cooking your shoes!
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.